good of mankind, nukes, drones, and robots. We're going to begin tonight with a talk by the iconic Dr. Helen Caldicott, who's gracing us with her presence tonight. Dr. Caldicott will speak about, among other things, the connection between the bombing of Hiroshima in 1945 and the ongoing crisis in Fukushima today. Of any two events in history, it is these two Japanese cataclysms that best spell out the need for total shutdown of nuclear power plants and total nuclear disarmament. Oh, speaking of disarmament, if you're as naive as me, you probably thought that with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the risk of nuclear war was practically obsolete. Well, last month, I don't know if you saw this, there was an article in the New York Times that said that the United States is actually expanding and modernizing its nuclear arsenal. I was shocked, because the U.S. policy is effectively reversing course on its long-standing agenda of disarmament in order to modernize an aging weapons system. The cost is going to be up to $1 trillion over the next 3 decades, according to a federal report. Even Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel has endorsed a military study that says we already have more than enough warheads in the stockpile to function as a deterrent. So I guess what it seems to be is that Congress is more interested in looking tough against Russia rather than in disarmament. And we're going to have Bruce Gagnon speak about the skewed and impractical priorities that our government is taking. Our historical fear of Russia has spawned not only nuclear bombs and atomic bombs, but also many other military innovations, if you want to call it that. As a matter of fact, if it wasn't for, of all things, the arms race with Russia, we wouldn't have iPads, Facebook, robot vacuum cleaners, Google Earth, Google Glass, and all these other digital technologies which were first developed during the Reagan Star Wars era. Now, as harmless or even empowering as these technologies might seem, it is their very digital quality that enables a level of totalitarian control to which military minds aspire. These technologies can combine with the expanded nuclear capabilities and create infinite potential for infinite permutations of evil. I'm reminded of my ex-husband now. No, he actually, his PhD in computer science was funded by the Pentagon so that he could develop a nuclear-powered robot tank that was operated remotely from halfway across the world, and if the enemy tried to strike the tank, it would retaliate by shooting off a nuclear weapon. So you have so many different layers of technology at work here. You've got GPS, robotics, nuclear, artificial intelligence, each layer further removing and virtualizing the human operator ever more from the reality of annihilation. It is absurd, it's even sick, to call this smart technology, yet this is the term that has been used very successfully, I might add, to market these products to the American people and the rest of the world. So the moral, political, and environmental implications of wars fought remotely is not something that's commonly talked about in the United States. It might be talked about in Palestine or places where we shoot drones off, but not here. What is talked about is how... Oh, by the way, I wanted to mention that Gar Smith is going to be speaking about robots and drones and the various killbots that are in use today. Now, what is talked about when we talk about robots and drones in war is how they eliminate casualties, American casualties. Now, this justification is chillingly reminiscent of when the atom bomb was first introduced to the American people. Harry Truman said that he was forced to drop those bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki because otherwise thousands of lives would be lost on the battlefield. He saved thousands of American lives. Well, it turns out that this was a lie. Japan had already offered several scenarios for surrender months before, all of which Truman totally ignored. He was determined to drop those bombs on Japan in order to show Russia, not Japan, that a post-war world would be ruled supremely by the United States. So, as the 50s came along, Eisenhower became president, the arms race with Russia ramped up, and the marketing of nukes also ramped up to the American people. The Pentagon was short of the plutonium, which was the central ingredient to making bombs that it needed to participate in the arms race with Russia. So Eisenhower's solution to the plutonium shortage was to promote nuclear power for the first time. Nuclear power produces as a byproduct the needed plutonium. So during Eisenhower's presidency, the number of warheads in the arsenal rose from about 1,000 to about 22,000. The name of his his marketing campaign for nuclear power was Atoms for Peace. Maybe you've heard of it in history books. So obviously this had way less to do with peace than it did with obfuscating the real agenda of a nuclear arms buildup. During the Atoms for Peace years, or the so-called Atoms for Peace years, 67 live atomic bombs were dropped on the Marshall Islands over the course of 12 years, the equivalent of 7,000 Hiroshima bombs. There were people living there. The Marshallese people agreed to the testing after a U.S. military official told them that it was, quote, for the good of mankind, end quote. Today, the exquisitely beautiful Marshallese Islands and their crystalline lagoons are unlivably and permanently contaminated with radioactivity. And today we have Nyssen Locken is with us. She's from the Marshall Islands. She actually lived through these tests, and she'll talk about that in a few moments. So the Atoms for Peace years for the Marshallese and people like Nyssen were nothing but an endless plague of illness, early deaths, birth defects that go on, passed on generation after generation after generation. So I'm going to wrap up because I'm really actually just the moderator, but I wanted to say that when we think about technology, let's think about why was it developed. These technologies were developed expressly for the purpose of controlling or ending life. And the spin-offs of these technologies are what we use today for all of our convenient mobile devices. So now let's hear from our speakers. They'll give us some more details on the real impacts to Earth and humanity. So Helen Caldicott is one of the world's most articulate and passionate advocates of citizen action to remedy the nuclear and environmental crises. She is a doctor of pediatrics and has devoted the last 42 years to educating the public about the medical hazards of the nuclear age and the necessary changes in human behavior to stop environmental destruction. Dr. Caldicott has received many prizes and awards for her work, including the Lannan Foundation's Prize for Cultural Freedom in 2003 and 21 honorary doctoral degrees. She was personally nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Linus Pauling, himself a Nobel laureate. The Smithsonian named Dr. Caldicott as one of the most influential women of the 20th century. She has written for numerous publications and has authored 7 books, the most recent of which is entitled Crisis Without End, the medical and ecological consequences of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Please give a hand for Dr. Caldicott.
Thank you very much. Well, we've heard a little bit of history of the nuclear age, and I won't go through it all, but it did start with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. A little boy in Hiroshima was reaching up to catch a red dragonfly in his hand against the blue of the sky, and there was a blinding flash, and he disappeared. His shadow was on the pavement, and that is in the Hiroshima Museum. That was the first time that man had developed a technique to vaporize his fellow human beings. People were watching the plane above and saw two parachutes open, and they thought that the pilots were escaping, and then there was a blinding flash. About 120,000 people were killed in Hiroshima, and people evacuated from Hiroshima who survived and went to the only Christian center in Japan, which was Nagasaki, 3 days later to receive the second bomb. The Japanese say, "We understand the first, well, some do, but why the second?" The Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission in America studied the Hiroshima and Nagasaki victims. They never compensated them. They never treated them. They just studied them to see what radiation did to human beings, similarly to the way they've treated the Marshall Islands. No medical treatment, no insurance, just study them. Guinea pigs. So Japan was pretty allergic to nuclear, all things nuclear after that. There was a psychologist in the Pentagon who said in the 50s that if America developed the peaceful atom, then people would get over their anaphylactic reaction to nuclear weapons. And that's partly why the peaceful atom was developed. And that's why it was introduced by General Electric and others into Japan, so they would get over their vast abhorrence of anything nuclear. I knew the three GE engineers who designed the reactors in Fukushima, Mark 1 GE reactors. It's GE who should be being sued, not TEPCO, GE. And those three wonderful men resigned in 1975, saying that these reactors were very dangerous. They testified before Congress, but of course that made no difference. It was said at the time that the chance of a meltdown was being hit by lightning in a parking lot. Since then, we've had Three Mile Island, which had a partial meltdown 13 miles from Hershey's Chocolates, where the cows graze in the richest dairy area of the country. The milk was so radioactive and full of radioactive iodine that they powdered the milk for 100 days until the radioactive iodine decayed, then they used it for the chocolates. But many other isotopes escaped with lives that last for hundreds of thousands of years. We don't know the ground levels of radiation around Hiroshima. Hiroshima. Hershey's chocolates, sorry about that. So don't eat Hershey's chocolates. Then we got Chernobyl. Now, all of these accidents occurred as a result of human failure. And here's Chernobyl here. This is the map of Europe. And the very dark red areas are where people cannot live, exclusion zones. And you'll see that that they actually went up to Finland, Sweden, Norway. The very dark red areas are exclusion. These are not so dark. But the fallout occurred all over Europe. So there was one stupid man who, in the middle of the night, who is a specialist in hydroelectricity, not nuclear, did a crazy experiment, and there was a huge bang. And he said to his two underlings, "Go out and see what's happened." So they went out and they came back and they said, "It's gone." He said, What's gone?" They said, "The reactor's gone." He said, "Don't be ridiculous. Go out and have another look." When the explosion occurred, the control room filled up with white dust. All of those men died soon after of acute radiation illness. What I'm not showing you here is Turkey, which got a hell of a fallout. Their tea was so radioactive and they were so angry with Russia that they picked all the radioactive tea and sent it back to Russia so they could drink radioactive tea. Do not eat any apricots from Turkey, hazelnuts and the like. Turkey is very radioactive. There are wild boars running around Germany right now, so radioactive they almost glow in the dark. There are lambs being born in farms in the United Kingdom, so full of cesium-137 that they can't be sold on the market. Europe will remain radioactive for hundreds up to thousands of years. And a study done by the New York Academy of Sciences shows that by now over a million people have died as a result of Chernobyl. From cancer, leukemia, premature aging in children, sudden heart attacks, diabetes. There's a variety of illnesses, and I would advise you to read that report from the New York Academy of Sciences, one of the most startling medical documents that I've ever read. It's been discredited by some pro-nuclear people in the academy because it wasn't properly peer-reviewed. It's the only document where they translated 5,000 papers written in Slavic into English, where they actually counted the patients, did the studies, did the epidemiology, and the pro-nuclear people don't like it. It's an absolutely outstandingly terrifying report. Then we got Fukushima. Okay, this one. Should, maybe that one will. Sorry, how do I go back? All right, well, you don't need to see this, Fukushima. At the time of the earthquake, which was a 9 on the Richter scale, there were 6 reactors in Fukushima Daiichi. 3 were online and 3 were not. 1 had just had its fuel removed to a cooling pool at the top, standing on the roof of the reactor 100 feet above the ground, but 3 were operating. So because they lost the external power supply to operate the pumps, because each reactor needs 1 million gallons a minute to keep it cool of circulating water, and that water comes out relatively radioactive, the pumps failed, and so they had diesel generators, but they were located underneath the reactors, and as the tsunami came in, the diesel generators were drowned. So desperate were the workers that they rushed out to get batteries from their cars to try and mobilise the pumps, but they didn't work. Within hours, units 1, 2 and 3 started to melt down. Each 100 tonnes of incredibly hot, incredibly radioactive uranium full of fission products. And within a few days, there had been a total meltdown in 3. They'd melted their way through 6 inches of steel, dropped onto the containment floor made of concrete, and some people think they've gone and melted their way into the earth. The reactors were built in front of a mountain range, and huge amounts of water fall down every year beneath the reactors to the sea. That was okay when they were intact, but now the water comes down from the mountains, mixes with the molten cores, picking up plutonium, americium, neptunium, strontium, cesium, carbon-14, tritium, and flows out to the Pacific. Every day since the accident 3.5 years ago, 300 to 400 tons of water per day, very radioactive, has poured into the Pacific. There is no way for us to stop the water pouring over the reactor cores. There is no way ever to find the reactor cores because they're so radioactive that men cannot, or women can't, go near them, or they'll die within a few hours with their hair falling out, vomiting and bleeding to death. Even when they send robots in, the robots fry. So this accident is ongoing, hence the name of the book, which is out there, called Crisis Without End. The Pacific Ocean is becoming more and more radioactive. Yeah, it's a huge body of water. But the solution to pollution by dilution is fallacious when it comes to radiation, because the radioactive elements reconcentrate back in the food chain by orders of magnitude. Algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, tuna they're catching on the west coast now, this country containing cesium from Fukushima. And so we stand at the apex of the food chain. You can't taste, smell or see radiation. Do not buy ever any Japanese food again. No miso, no seaweed, no fish, no rice. They're encouraging farmers to grow their food now in Fukushima Prefecture, and they're selling it in London. They're canning the most radioactive food and selling it to the developing world. Do not eat any Japanese food. Once you've eaten radioactive elements, it takes up to 2 to 80 years to develop your cancer. The cancer doesn't wear a little flag denoting its origin. And then we try and treat you and nearly kill you as we try and kill the cancer. More Fukushima. This is the nuclear fallout released by the Australian Radiation Service. And so you can see Japan within 3 days, 6 days, and here it is hitting Seattle. The ambient levels of radiation in Seattle went up 40,000 times above normal within the first week. The wind blew across the Pacific for the first 2 days, then changed and blew across Japan. People fled into the areas of the highest radiation fallout because the government didn't warn them where it was going. Well, this shows more. On the 18th, the accident was the 11th of March, 18th of March, 21st of March, and here it's surrounding the whole of the Northern Hemisphere. We don't get it in the south because the two air masses don't mix at the equator. So here the radiation moved up here. The Americans were monitoring it, the Japanese were monitoring it, but the Japanese government didn't tell them where it was going because they didn't want to create panic. So they fled into the highest radiation zones. Thousands and thousands of people, including children who are 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults, fetuses thousands of times more so. We'll pass over this. These are airborne emissions, but there are many more, from a meltdown. Uranium, which has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, very toxic. They're using it in Iraq, and they have been in a nuclear war, really, with depleted uranium. Plutonium, the most carcinogenic substance we know, a millionth of a gram will cause you cancer. Half-life 24,400 years, lasts for half a million years. That's what you make hydrogen bombs from. Produces liver, lung and bone cancer. Cesium-137 lasts for 600 years and produces cancers in muscle, brain, like. Strontium-90, like calcium, lasts for 600 years and goes to bone, causing bone cancer and leukemia. Cobalt-60, terribly dangerous, and radioactive iodine, causing thyroid cancer. I've just gone through those. This is Tokyo soon after the accident, and the azaleas are dying in the middle of summer from fallout. There are parts of Tokyo that are as radioactive as the exclusion zones around Chernobyl. And this is a ginkgo with spots on it. These are the radioactive particles that landed on the ginkgo and caused the ginkgo to die. This is soil testing in the Tokyo metropolitan area. Some parts of Tokyo are extraordinarily radioactive. These are the deformities we saw after Chernobyl. There are homes full of the most deformed children. These are mentally retarded children. This is Chernobyl. This guy has elephantiasis. She's got an absent eye. But homes full of the most deformed children we've ever seen in the history of pediatrics, like thalidomide babies who are born with no arms, no legs, and the like. There's a strong history of conjoined twins too, Siamese twins. This is the book from the National Academy of Sciences, and you see the growth wings of the trees before Chernobyl and after. They hardly grew. This is what Arjun Makajani, because of David Freeman, a study I commissioned called Carbon Free, Nuclear Free. America could be carbon free, nuclear free, actually by 2030 now. There's a man called Tim Mousseau who's studying the mutations of the barn swallows around Chernobyl and Fukushima, and these white feathers are mutations. Here's a tumour, here's a deranged beak, here are crooked wings. 40% of the males are sterile, and they're developing also cataracts, which humans developed too, and there's a huge number of cataracts around Chernobyl from the radiation effect upon the eyes. These are the number of nuclear reactors, sorry about that, nuclear reactors in Europe. I mean, it's just covered. And you can't have a war in a country with nuclear reactors because then you get a nuclear war because the reactors most would melt down. This is a tomato not very well displayed from Fukushima with mutations. And these are all the radioactive elements in a reactor. I won't go through them all, but they just talk about tritium and cesium and strontium, but look at them all. There are over 100 of them. On and on. And they never, ever talk about all of this. And this is what... So if you have a meltdown at Indian Point, A, you'll never escape through all the tunnels and the bridges, You'll be trapped here if the wind's blowing over you. There'll be hundreds of thousands of people within 2 weeks with their hair falling out, vomiting, bleeding to death. There'll be acute leukemia developing within 2 to 5 years with people dying, thousands of them, and cancers. And guess what? That's what would close down the nuclear industry. Because Americans don't really care about the fate of the Japanese, nor do they care about the Russians, because when I was interviewed on ABC Radio after Chernobyl, the man said to me, but they're just Russians. I said, well, I'm a physician, a pediatrician, every life is sacred. I just want to move on to the next problem. There are two main problems confronting the fate of the Earth. We've heard one, which is global warming, but the other is nuclear war. We've still got 16,400 hydrogen bombs, 93% of which are owned by Russia and America. In New York, you've got 40 hydrogen bombs targeted on you as I speak. They would take half an hour after launch to land on you. One bomb would produce a firestorm of 3,000 square miles, and you would all die, all within 3,000 square miles of a catastrophic firestorm. There are 60 targeted on Washington. There's such a redundancy of weapons that they've got 60 on Moscow too. So the real terrorists in the world are nothing to do with ISIS or any of that rubbish. They are Russia and America threatening to destroy life on the planet. And it's time the politicians woke up and realised what was going on. So each Russia and America have 1,000 hydrogen bombs in their missiles ready to be launched with a press of the button and a 3-minute decision time by Putin or Obama. Always walking behind Obama is a man with a suitcase called the football, which has the codes to start a nuclear war. You'd think he'd understand that and say, for God's sake, I've got two little girls. I'm going to abolish nuclear weapons. He's got the pulpit, and he could do that, but he hasn't done it. God help us all. And the other thing is that recently they've fired over 70 missile officers. There are two men in each missile silo, aged 18 to 21, each with a pistol to shoot the other if one shows signs of deviant behaviour. The deviant one could shoot the normal one. The locks to turn, they operate on floppy disks. The telephones don't work all the time. 70 have been fired because they've been cheating on their tests, or they've been going to sleep on the job or taking drugs. If the weapons were used between Russia and America, as all the cities burn and the toxic, black, oily, radioactive smoke rises to the stratosphere, it will cover the Earth with a cloud so thick it blocks out the sun for up to 10 years, inducing a short ice age, nuclear winter, and most organisms, including ourselves, of course, would freeze to death in the dark, nuclear winter. If there's a small one between Pakistan and India, that would create nuclear autumn, all crops would fail, and billions would die. But we're talking about the end of human life. And that could happen tonight, because what's happening in the Ukraine is extraordinarily provocative. The State Department and the neocons have orchestrated the coup in the Ukraine. Yeltsin doesn't like it. Well, imagine if, you know, Russia moved into Canada and had a coup. Would you like it? America nearly blew up the world when Russia moved a few nuclear missiles in Cuba. How incredibly provocative of what they've done. And you can read about the coup on my webpage, nuclearfreeplanet.org. And I think Putin is being extraordinarily restrained in this situation, but what worries me is that with high anxiety on both sides, with human errors, with computer errors, and we've heard about that today, we could have an... I said to my family when I left, I'll see you when I get home if we don't have a nuclear war, and I'm serious. Putin has put his missiles on a higher state of alert. If he has, Stratcom has, your country, for sure. Russia and America are both conducting very provocative nuclear war games near each other's borders. Are you reading about this in the New York Times? Oh, no. It's Putin who's at fault. Well, you know, he's not a good man. He killed 250,000 people in Chechnya. But I'm talking about the future of life on the planet. And the New York Times has a goal not to report about this in an adequate way. Last but not least is artificial intelligence. Stephen Hawking and others are now writing articles that computers within 5 or 10 years will be so intelligent they can reproduce themselves, they will take over most activities that humans do, so millions will be out of jobs like robots and driverless cars and the like. You can't program compassion or morality into a computer. And what they're really worried about is within 10 years, and they're writing about this, is that computers actually could take leave of, not senses, but decide what they're going to do themselves, like a Frankenstein monster, and launch a nuclear war. And we've just heard that America is going to spend $1 trillion in the next 30 years to replace every single nuclear warhead, submarine, missile, ship, plane. How dare they? And you know why? Obama promised Senator Kyle that to pass the START treaty, which is nothing, that would happen. And so that's going in. This is obscene. So to finish, I'm holding a conference in New York on the 28th of February and March the 1st, the weekend, at the New York Academy of Medicine called The Dynamics of Possible Nuclear Extinction, covering all of these issues and more. So don't forget, it's not just global warming. Please. Thank you.
Our next speaker. Oh, actually, in a few moments before we hear from Nason, we will hear. Let me explain a little bit about her background. She's a native of Rongelap Atoll, the largest inhabited atoll in the Marshalls that was destroyed in the U.S. testing of nuclear weapons. She was 1 year old in 1953 when the Bravo test was dropped. That test alone was equivalent to 1,000 Hiroshima bombs. But before she takes the podium, we've got a brief ABC news piece that was done a few years ago that provides excellent background on the Marshalls, and then Nason will get up and speak.
Like a string of pearls, the Marshall Islands stretch across 500,000 square miles of the world's deepest water. A heavenly necklace of coral atolls. Except there is little harmony in this paradise. More than four decades of American rule have left the 43,000 Marshallese in discord. Poverty and illness are companions in the street. Most of the young are jobless. Many of the old have only bitter memories. Michua Anjan.
I don't like the American people or the American government. They have destroyed our culture.
For hundreds of years, the Marshallese were among the best fishermen and navigators in the Pacific. There was tuna from the water, copra from the land, but a tidal wave was coming from the modern world. In February 1944, Americans arrived here in force, beating back the Japanese who had claimed the Marshalls as a strategic base.
By the summer of 1944, the last of the Japanese had been driven from their bunkers, including this one on the island of Roi Namur. The Marshallese had been liberated, but they were not going to be left alone. Under a UN agreement, the U.S. took charge of the islands as a trust territory and a key military outpost. Between 1946 and 1958, islands the Marshallese called home, the U.S. government would call Ground Zero.
3, 2, 1, fire!
Six atomic bombs were detonated on the evacuated islands of Eniwetok and Bikini. The Cold War was hot, and America didn't need to seek approval from anyone, least of all the Marshallese. It was history's most massive atmospheric testing program, and one of the U.S. military's most remarkable public relations campaigns.
Well, now then, James, will you tell them that the United States government now wants to turn this great destructive force into something good for mankind, something good for mankind.
All right, is that all?
Okay, cut it.
convinced or coerced, hundreds of Marshallese were removed from their home islands, but not from harm's way. On March 1, 1954, the world's largest hydrogen bomb cracked the sky above Bikini with a force twice as great as scientists had expected, showering the islands with radioactive fallout. Children played in it as if it were snow.
Since the time of the bomb, things have never been right with the children. I had my thyroid taken out. My son died of leukemia. He was 1 year old at the time of the bomb.
Michua and her husband John, like countless other islanders, were never warned about the bomb. At the time, John was mayor of Rongelap Atoll, and among a small group of Marshallese who were later brought to the U.S. for radiation testing and a lesson in arrogance.
These are fishing people, savages by our standards. The Marshallese caught by fallout got 175 wrenches of radiation. Most humans are exposed to less than 20 wrenches in a lifetime. John, as we said, is a savage, but a happy, amenable savage.
For John Angine, these black and white memories have drained much of the color from his life.
There were many more problems after the bomb. The women are giving birth to children that are not like human beings. Those that survive have trouble growing and mental retardation as well.
I lived with people who are what World War III would look like if World War III were to break out.
Glenn Alkaly was a Peace Corps worker here. He's just begun an island-by-island survey of the radiation's after effects.
We're still counting bodies out there. We still don't have any adequate picture of how extensive the damage is. We don't know how many thousands of people were caught in this fallout.
Recent medical studies confirm long-term effects are still appearing. In a 1986 study, 91% of the Marshallese tested had radiation-induced blood disorders, and the same report found double the normal rate of stillbirths and miscarriages.
I have 7 miscarriages.
Lejeune Eknelane's 8th birthday fell on the day the bomb was dropped. 7 miscarriages later, she has not forgiven the United States.
I knew that if it wasn't what the United States have done for me and my family, my kids would be growing up like the others.
Was Bikini a mistake? Was Rongelap a mistake?
Oh, inevitably they were. But certainly not intentional mistakes.
Colonel Philip Harris commanded the U.S. military base on Kwajalein Atoll. He says Marshallese fears about long-term contamination are unwarranted.
Just from the standpoint of safety, would you go back to Bikini and live?
I've been on Bikini. There is absolutely no background radiation, zero. There is less background radiation on Bikini than there is in the capital of the United States. The only difficulty is the cesium.
That's cesium-137. It's contaminated island plants and topsoil. In 1985, the danger from lingering radiation prompted the environmental group Greenpeace to evacuate hundreds of Marshallese from Rongelap Atoll, but only after the U.S. government refused to relocate them. Nuclear nomads, the people of Rongelap, now live on an atoll more than 100 miles from their home. Rongelap Senator Jetton Angine.
Our land is our sacred position. That's all we have. And today, our land has been destroyed. We cannot use it anymore. We cannot go there and live in peace because of the contamination.
Are you troubled at all by the American nuclear legacy here in the Marshall Islands?
No. I personally don't feel bad. In fact, I'm very proud that we, as many other nations, didn't just pick up and walk away and say, sorry about that, that's your problem.
Of course, that's precisely what the Marshallese claim has happened. Negotiating with the U.S. for their independence in 1986, the Marshallese agreed to a one-time payment of $150 million to cover all damages caused by the years of atomic testing. Marshall Island President Amitai Kabua says it was the price for freedom.
We lost many things in that compact. We regret them, but what can you do? I mean, when you grow up with your brothers and he's a lot bigger than you and he slaps you, what do you do?
That's not apathy, it's reality. That American big brother has stolen much of the soul and self-sufficiency of the Marshallese.
our entire educational system, health system, transportation system, everything depends on 90% of it depends on the United States grants.
Tony DeBroom is a Marshall Islands senator.
The sun is practically set on Marshallese culture.
Eclipsed might be a better description. Consider Kwajalein Atoll, leased to the U.S. for the next 26 years. The Marshallese who once lived here have been moved to make way for the American military base. The lagoon where islanders once caught fish now catches incoming test missiles from California, 4,200 miles away. Part transplanted suburb, part country club, it's home to some 3,000 Americans, but off limits to the Marshallese. They're allowed to work here, but not to live.
On the right here, we have the brand new youth center, just completed construction. On the one side, it has a big dance floor, and on the other side, games and so on and so forth.
From Kwajalein's manicured lawns and baseball parks, it's just 15 minutes across the lagoon to Ibai, home to many of the radiation exiles. Nearly 10,000 Marshallese jammed onto 78 acres of hot, treeless coral. Called the slum of the Pacific, it's among the most crowded places on Earth.
How many families are in some of these homes?
Oh, we're talking one room would be maybe 10 by 10, and you have three families.
Julian Ricklin is a local government worker.
There are children everywhere here.
Children everywhere. That's your body.
And you see children on garbage dumps. Why are they playing on the garbage
They're dump? Using the... This is a playground because there's no playground on Ibai.
Stalking the children and adults here is a cluster of diseases from both the first and third worlds.
Nason Locken is a pastor with her husband of 41 years at the First Micronesian Assembly of God Church in Reeds, Missouri. This year, Ms. Locken has begun to speak publicly around the United States about how the continual nuclear bombardment from 1946 to 58 has affected her health, the health of her people, and of her homeland.
Thank you. Sorry, I'm trying to compose myself. My name is Najin Anjain Logan, and I'm from Rongelap Atoll. I was only 4 years old when the U.S. returned the Rongelap people back to the island. Because I was young at the time, I didn't understand a lot of things. But I remember they told us not to eat any local foods as well as food from the ocean. The AEC doctors, they came to the islands every year in January and brought seafood and sea rations with them for us to eat. But when we ran out of food, we had no choice. We had to get food from the ocean or the land. I remember eating some of the food that they told us not to eat. I had blister in my mouth. I remember people getting sick, vomiting, diarrhea, flu-like sickness. We got blisters on our feet from walking on the sand. We didn't understand what was going on. Nobody explained it to us. But we knew that it was because of the bomb and the radiation that fell on the islands. On March 1st, 1954, as you know, an hydrogen bomb called Bravo was dropped over Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands, causing radiation fall out across all the islands, especially Bikini and Aniwetok and the inhabited atolls of Wrongleb and Uzrak. Because I am from Wrongleb, I will only speak to what happened there on Wrongleb. My uncle John Anjain, who you saw in the picture, was the mayor of Wrongleb at the time, and he talked about what happened there in 1954. And this is his statement, and I'm going to read it to you. On March 1st, he was awakened at 5 o'clock in the morning. He was getting ready to go fishing. He and another man, they were making coffee outside of their houses. They saw a bright light to the west of Wrongleb. When the light reached Wrongleb, there were many colors, beautiful colors. People came out to see, yellow, red, green. No one knew what was going on or what was happening. Then there was a gust of wind that came from west. It was so strong that some people staggered, including my uncle, John Anjain. They saw smoke cloud. My uncle stood there and watched the cloud and heard a loud sound, louder than thunder. Women and children were so scared, they ran into the woods. Once the sound died out, everyone started doing their normal daily activities. Some of the men went fishing, like my uncle, and when he was walking along the beach and saw the sky, he said it looked like it was white, like smoke. He went ahead and got some fish, then went to get some coconuts. He went back to the beach and started eating. Then the powder started falling, began to fall. He looked at the trees, and they turned white, as well as his entire body. Everything turned white. He didn't know that this was dangerous. The powder fell all day long and all night long. My cousin, Erosi Gebenly, who you saw in the picture, was in a coconut tree when the powder fell. It started itching and he ran into the ocean. It got worse. Other children play in the white powder. Maybe they thought it must be snow or soap or something. They didn't know what it was. Later, people went to get water. It had turned yellowish color. Then they realized that the powder that fell all day long and all night long was harmful. But the people still ate and drank contaminated food and water. People were sick, very, very sick. On March 2nd, two men came to Wrongleb to inspect the damage from the bomb. They told my uncle they were going to stay 20 minutes, but they didn't even stay 10 minutes. They left. They didn't even tell the people how dangerous the bomb was. They didn't even tell them not to eat the food and drink the water. They left without telling them anything. The next day, the people's hair started falling out. They had burned skin. They were sick with vomiting, diarrhea, headaches, aches all over their body. They let them fend for themselves. On the third day, people came with a plane and ship. They told them to get on board, not to take anything with them. Anyone who's thinking about staying behind would die. But before they got on board, they stripped them naked. Men and women, together, they sprayed them down. They gave the women men T-shirts and underwear to wear. And they went to another island called Island Nine to pick up more people there. They did the same thing to them, stripped them naked, sprayed them down, boarded them onto the ship. Then they took them to Kwajalein and left them there for 3 months. They took the woman to the Lukun side, bathed them 3 times a day to wash themselves with soap. And every time they would check them for radiation, they needed 2 interpreters to talk with them. These 2 men, interpreters, saw their sisters, their mothers, their daughters stripped naked right in front of them. They stayed there 3 months. Then they took them to another island of Metro called Edges. The people had to build their homes and were left to fend for themselves. They stayed there for 3 years. Then they decided, they had a meeting and decided to take them back to Rongla. They built them some houses on Rongla. My uncle asked them why they were taking them back if the island was still dangerous. They told him that it was contaminated, but it was not dangerous. But if anything was anybody was thinking about remaining on Edges, then they have to fend for themselves. So the people had no choice. They had to go back to Rongla, the contaminated atoll. I was with them on the trip back to Rongla. Like I said, I was young, and I didn't understand many things. But I saw people die of cancers, babies born with deformed bodies. Some of them you could see their brain, their bone, backbones. Some babies that were born didn't look like human beings. They looked like animals or other things. I asked one of my cousins, why didn't you take pictures of the babies that were born deformed? She said, I was ashamed. I was hurt. And I didn't want people to see them. I didn't want them to know what happened. I left Rongla and went to high school. I was 14 years old. One day the doctors came to the school and gathered all the people from Rongla to take them to hospital to examine them. It was shameful for me because people made fun of us. They say, there goes the poison people. They didn't want to associate with us or come near us. There was a boy who wanted to date me, but I was contaminated. He didn't want anything to do with me. But it's okay, he was a bone loser. I'm glad I married my husband for 41 years, 7 kids, 13 grandkids. I consider myself very blessed. So I grew up ashamed and hurt and thought all the people of Rongla were some kind of livers. All things that I grew up hearing, my grandmothers and the elders, every time they talk about things, they started crying because of everything that happened to them. But no one told them or explaining anything to them. So it was like nothing had happened and no one cares. It took them a long time before they got any kind of help with health care. When the doctors came to the island to check us once a year, they took samples, urine and blood, but never told us anything that was happening. People were sick with thyroid problems and cancer. My cousin Ligis Anjang, he was only a year old when the powder fell on the island. But as a teenager in 1965, they brought him here to the state so they could examine him. They brought my uncle here too and told him he was really, really sick. They said he had leukemia. His son never returned to Rongla. He took him back to Rongla in a box. My cousin Hiroshi Kevenly, who was on the tree when the powder fell, he died when he was a teenager. I was in the United States when the people was evacuated from the island in 1985 by Greenpeace in a boat called Rainbow Warrior. In 1975, my father went to Japan and asked for help. No one from the United States would help, so my father went on television and radio and asked for help. Scientists from Japan came and they said, remove these people because the island was three times worse than Hiroshima. About 5 years ago, I was sick. They said it was an infected lymphoid all over my neck, abnose, bleed. Doctors said they don't know what caused it and said it was really hard to get rid of it. I was sick for 3 years. And they gave me all kinds of antibiotics. Until now, I still don't understand. I still don't know. But I do know that I was on the island and consumed food and water that was contaminated. So I know I was affected by the bomb, too. All these things happen to us, and we don't know why. But we are trying to tell people what happened. It is not a shameful thing for me to talk about it anymore. But it is really sad thing for me to talk about what happened to our islands. I left Rangla when I was 11 years old in 1964, and I have never returned. I miss it very much. You might say, I am lucky to be alive today. But I say, I am here by the grace of God. He's still on his throne, and he's still in control. So I could curse America, but I'm going to say, God bless America. God bless you all. And thank you for listening to my story.
We're so lucky to have Nason here because she's such a great teacher of how to survive when your earth, your land, has been utterly destroyed. The health of your family and yourself has been destroyed. Even the health of your descendants has been destroyed. And I feel like the Marshallese are all sort of Christ figures, and they have a lot to teach us. Yes, it is genocide, and actually there is a court case pending or being prepared by the Marshallese government against the United States. Not in the international court, but rather in the U.S. court for genocide. So that will be very interesting. Our next speaker is Bruce Gagnon, the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Mr. Gagnon is a recipient of the Benjamin Spock Peacemaker Award. He was featured on 60 Minutes for organizing a campaign which protested the launch of 72 pounds of plutonium into space in 1997 on the Cassini space mission. In 2003, Bruce co-produced a popular video entitled Arsenal of Hypocrisy that spells out U.S. plans for space domination. In 2006, he produced another video entitled The Necessity of the Conversion of the Military-Industrial Complex.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for sticking around for this last panel. We appreciate it. I live in Bath, Maine, where Navy destroyers are built. These ships are outfitted with so-called missile defense systems that the Pentagon today is using to help surround Russia and China. Few people in my community, including activists, are particularly interested in where these ships will go or what their military mission is. It's not popular to raise these questions, especially when Bath Iron Works is the largest industrial employer in our state. In the U.S. today, 59 cents of every federal discretionary tax dollar goes to the Pentagon to fund the cancerous war machine. Our communities have become addicted to to military spending as our physical and social infrastructure continues to deteriorate. There is virtually no money for anything else these days as we witness austerity cuts in social programs here in this country and all around the globe. The Pentagon says that America's role under corporate globalization of the world economy will be security export. We won't have conventional jobs making useful things in our communities. Instead, we will build weapons for endless war and send our kids overseas to die on behalf of oil corporations. In fact, today, weapons are the number one industrial export product of the U.S. And when weapons are your number one industrial export product, what is your global marketing strategy for that product line? What does it say about the soul of our nation that we have to keep selling weapons and killing people around the globe in order to provide jobs for workers so they can feed their families? In addition to coordinating the global network, I'm also a member of Veterans for Peace. And just days ago, we completed a low-tech 125-mile walk across parts of our state that we called Walk for Peace and a Sustainable Future. Increasingly, the only real job investment money coming into Maine and across the nation from the federal government is for military weapons production. So now nearly 10% of Maine's economy is reliant on weapons contracts. We began the walk up in the beautiful mountains and lake region called Rangeley, where the Pentagon's Missile Defense Agency is considering putting up to 60 so-called missile defense interceptors, which in fact are key elements in U.S. first strike attack planning and are aimed at Russia and China. Narrow winding roads would have to be bulldozed and widened, and huge holes would have to be blasted into the mountains in order to insert the missile silos. Toxic fuel would be trucked in and stored on site, the same rocket fuel that is now contaminating water sources in 22 states across the nation. The whole plan would be an environmental disaster and would cost taxpayers more than $4 billion. This program is an important illustration of how our nation increasingly puts blind trust and faith in space technology to fight modern wars. Come to find out, the Pentagon didn't even want this expensive program, but pressure on Congress from the Boeing Corporation forced it to go forward with an environmental impact statement process in public hearings in four states, including Maine, to select an East Coast deployment site for the missile defense base. Another major weapons program being built that the Pentagon didn't actually want is also in Bath, Maine, where I live. General Dynamics Corporation owns Bath Iron Works, where the destroyers for the Navy are built. The standard destroyer previously cost $1.5 billion each, and is outfitted with another version of these missile defense interceptor missiles, which have had much success in their testing program. But after Obama became president, he forced the Pentagon to build the new high-tech stealth destroyer that they call the Zumwalt class destroyer, the job of which is to sneak up on China and blast it with an electromagnetic railgun and other weapon systems. This is part of Obama's pivot of 60% of U.S. military forces into the Asia Pacific to provocatively confront and control China. As it turns out, the majority stockholders of the General Dynamics Corporation are the Crown family in Chicago, who helped Obama get elected to the presidency. So we owed them. And the new Zumwalt stealth destroyer, at a cost to taxpayers of between $4 to $6 billion per copy, is their reward. As part of the U.S. pivot to China, the Pentagon needs more airfields for warplanes, more barracks for troops, and more ports of call for ships being deployed into the Asia Pacific. So in places like Jeju Island, South Korea, we see a 500-year-old farming and fishing culture being torn apart, and UNESCO-recognized World Heritage soft coral reefs just offshore being destroyed as a Navy base is being built for U.S. nuclear subs, aircraft carriers, and the destroyers made in my hometown of Bath. Endangered coral reefs in the Philippines, Australia, Hawaii, Okinawa, and other places are similarly being severely impacted by U.S. military expansion across the region. The global network is working hard to build international support for the local struggles against U.S. military devastation of the environment and the way of life in these communities. The Pentagon has the largest carbon footprint on the planet today. But sadly, there is little acknowledgement of that fact by most climate change groups, which well illustrates, I believe, the off-limits nature of the growing military domination of our society. Some environmental leaders have told me over the years that they don't want to negatively impact their positive working relationship with Democrats in Congress by taking on the more controversial military issues, which most Democrats fully support because they bring jobs to their districts. We've become an occupied nation. The corporate oligarchy that runs the show in Washington uses space-based technologies to spy on us and to direct all warfare on the planet. In a way, you could call today's expensive military satellites the triggers that make the high-tech weapons like drones and missiles work. These satellites allow the military to see everything on the Earth, to hear everything on the Earth, and to target virtually every place on the planet. The military-industrial complex has become the primary resource extraction service for corporate capitalism and is preparing the future generations for its dead-end street of endless war. In the U.S., approximately 40% of all scientists, engineers, and technical professionals currently work in the military sector. This is a colossal waste of talent and intellectual resources as we face the coming reality of climate change. Due to the fiscal crisis across the nation, engineering, computer science, mathematics, astronomy, and chemistry departments in colleges and universities have become increasingly dependent on military funding. We're sold the line that high-tech robotic warfare will save American lives and will be a cheaper way to fight. One key reason for the militarization of space is also as a resource extraction strategy so that they can go out to the planetary bodies and get the precious resources that we're running out of back here at home on the Earth. And to do this, they say they need nuclear power in space. They need it for mining the sky. International space law is now being rewritten to allow corporate control of the planetary bodies. The plan is to scrap the United Nations Moon and Outer Space treaties so that the corporations can claim private ownership of the planetary bodies. Rovers on Mars today are powered with plutonium-238. In 1989, in 1990, and then again in 1997, I organized campaigns at the Kennedy Space Center to protest and try to block launches of these radioactive plutonium launches into space. And today we hear space entrepreneur Elon Musk say that we've got to move our civilization to Mars. And in fact, the organization called the Mars Society says the Earth is a rotting, dying, stinking planet, and we have to move our civilization to Mars. Imagine the cost of doing that. The militarization of everything around us is indeed a spiritual sickness. Lakota holy man Lame Deer, many years ago, talked about the green frog skin, the dollar bill, and how the white man was blinded by his love for the paper money. His spiritual connection to the Mother Earth was broken. In 1877, the great Lakota warrior Crazy Horse was brought onto the reservation in South Dakota as the Indian Wars came to an end. Along with the end of the Civil War just 12 years before, the military-industrial complex at the time saw an end to its massive war profits. It needed an enemy to keep the production lines going. So a strategy was developed. Journalists and artists were paid to fabricate stories saying that Crazy Horse had broken out of the reservation and was going back on the warpath, killing innocent civilians, children, white children, raping white women, and burning their houses to the ground. These stories were printed in major newspapers across the nation, and the American people were outraged and afraid, and they called upon Congress to do something about it. And of course, Congress complied, swung into action, and appropriated more money for weapons production, while Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull sat inside their teepees on the reservation without a gun to their name. Similarly, in our times, we've seen the military-industrial complex fabricate stories about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And today we see ISIS, which has been trained, armed, funded, and directed by the CIA and Saudi Arabia as the justification for the U.S. to get back into Iraq and to bomb Syria. With so many communities now across the nation addicted to military spending, we need a transitional strategy to deal with the jobs issue, because literally we as a people, as a movement in this country, are held hostage by this jobs issue, as so many people now and so many communities are dependent on military production. Studies by the Economics Department at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst show that military spending creates the fewest jobs, while spending on rail, wind turbines, education, healthcare, repairing our sewer and water systems, and other such things creates more jobs with the same amount of money. Abolitionist Frederick Douglass reminded us that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will. When it comes to our current evil, dark economic system called militarism, we should be talking about its conversion and the jobs that would result from that transformation. Good jobs could be created for home weatherization and building rail systems that would get us out of our gas-guzzling cars. Legions of unemployed workers could be hired to work in towns and city organic, to create city town and city organic farms. And as we reject our military-industrial base, we lessen the obvious oppressive war machine on our lives. without massive cuts in the Pentagon budget, now, immediately, we cannot kickstart our needed social redirection. The integration of the economic conversion issue into the existing work of the peace, environmental, labor, and social justice movements could be a transformative strategy that would unify our disparate efforts and provide the despondent American people with a positive vision for the future. We don't have any time to waste. Thank you very much.
But then we harnessed horses for battle. Swords were a weapon of choice until guns were invented. Chariots slowly evolved into tanks, and in less than 100 years, this turned into this. But the change that's now underway will be the most significant in human history, as soldiers from the world's richest countries will soon rarely come face to face with their enemies. This is a profile of the robotic takeover of the world's militaries. For years now, the military of the United States and our closest allies have been using a whole range of robotic systems, like remotely controlled robots now commonly used for surveillance and for destroying bombs. Close-in weapons systems on board virtually every ship in the West's Navy can destroy incoming missiles, aircraft, and smaller, faster boats, all without human assistance. Unmanned ground vehicles guard areas and attack enemies using lethal and non-lethal weapons. The MQ Reaper unmanned aerial vehicle is a long-range killer that's so effective, America's 174th Fighter Wing has become the first squadron in history to convert from flying fighter jets to an all-remotely piloted UAV attack group. The secretive stealth unmanned RQ-170 drone that the U.S. lost control of over Iran in 2011. Tiny surveillance drones the size of small birds or insects. A robotic, remote-controlled sentry gun that's replacing human guards on the South Korean side of the demilitarized zone, and for Israel, along the Gaza border fence. And the Protector, an unmanned speedboat used by the Singapore Navy to patrol the busiest port in the world, the Israeli Navy to enforce its blockade of the Gaza Strip, and the Mexican Navy to confront highly creative drug smugglers. Some have called for a halt in the development of military robotics technology, but the U.S., its allies, and key adversaries continue to make their militaries as technologically advanced as possible because of the massive tactical advantage it gives them. The Pentagon currently deploys some 11,000 UAVs and 12,000 ground robots across the world, making America the clear leader, but China has already demonstrated several prototype systems that may be just as sophisticated as some in the American arsenal. The Russians have begun deploying armed robots to increase security at its ballistic missile bases and may deploy unmanned airships to monitor its interests in the Arctic. Worldwide, military spending on the robotics industry is projected to hit $7.5 billion by 2018. But it's not just governments doing the investing. Google has begun buying up robotics companies, positioning itself to dominate the commercial market, estimated to be worth around $37 billion by 2018. Google, or another tech company like it, could become the next generation's dominant defense contractor. Some of the projects that we know are in development for military use and should hit the battlefield in the coming years include the Knifefish, an underwater minesweeping robot that will replace the Navy's trained dolphins and sea lions in 2017, an unmanned autonomous helicopter carrying a remotely operated sniper rifle. Unmanned ground vehicles of the future will increasingly perform automated surveillance, reconnaissance, assault, and breaching missions. Other UGVs will simply retrofit existing Humvees and tanks with sensors and cameras to make them autonomous. Boston Dynamics humanoid robots will be used for search and rescue, and their big dog robotic pack mule will accompany soldiers into terrain that's too difficult for conventional vehicles. Unmanned missile barges will provide extra weapons for existing destroyers. Cruise missiles that are smart and networked to autonomously coordinate and swarm their attack so as to ensure maximum damage to their target. A joint aerial layer network will link all air assets and all other military assets in a region to provide maximum coordination and efficiency. High-speed unmanned fighters and bombers will fly alongside manned aircraft until they take over the Air Force completely. They'll be piloted by soldiers located safely back on a ship or on some faraway base. and undetectable underwater pods will be placed in the ocean weeks, months, or even years ahead of time, and eventually given a command to release unmanned submarines or unmanned aerial vehicles that will float to the surface and then take to the air. The reason that militaries will turn to robots to fight its battles is obvious. It'll keep their soldiers from getting killed. But, like many problems posed by our increasingly technological world, removing the human connection to what war viscerally feels like on the ground, where it's being fought, will create a whole new set of challenges. Many of the American pilots now flying drone missions in Iraq and Afghanistan already do so from places like Arizona, far away from the battlefield, which means they can bomb a group of people and then half an hour later be sitting safely at home with their families. It's no surprise that this extreme daily contrast is causing these soldiers to experience high rates of PTSD. Then there's the idea that by further removing the human cost of war from the equation, we risk becoming more tolerant of our governments engaging in armed conflicts. And then there's the unknown. What happens when two nuclear-armed states engage in a direct robots-on-robots battle? How does one win that kind of conflict? And when does losing one justify starting a war between living, breathing human beings? These are questions we are going to learn the answers to in the first half of the 21st century. If you enjoyed this video, hit that like button and share it to start your own conversation. Click on the screen to watch a TED Talk that explores some of these challenges, or our newest video, or a video about how robots are probably going to take almost all of our jobs, and you can take our poll. Will the rise of robots in our militaries ultimately be a good or bad thing for mankind? Thanks for watching. For The Daily Conversation, I'm Bryce Plank.
Pretty eye-opening, isn't it? Our next speaker will speak on robotics, Gar Smith. He is a Project Censored award-winning investigative journalist, editor, and editor emeritus of Earth Island Journal and co-founder of Environmentalists Against War. He has covered revolutions in Central America and has engaged in environmental campaigns on three continents. A veteran of the 1964 free speech movement, he lives a low-impact, solar-assisted lifestyle in Berkeley, California. Gar is also the author of Nuclear Roulette, The Truth About the Most Dangerous Energy Source on Earth. Gar.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for staying in here, giving a new advanced meaning to the phrase staying power. I'm really honored to be the final speaker. Speaker 29, we've had quite a day here today, and there will be more tomorrow. Bruce's speech was so great, it should have been the concluding anthem of this event, at least for today. But I'm here to talk about robots, and not just about the militarization issue, but I want to think deeper about why robots, and then beyond that, whither. As I was thinking about it, it occurred to me that really facsimiles of the human form have been with us for a long time, and I think to a great degree they stem from the same source, the profound realization among humans that our bodies are ephemeral, that we wither and die. But thanks to the human mind and the opposable thumb, we stumbled upon the ability to render facsimiles of human life and natural life. But throughout the years, I discovered there have been a small coterie of individuals who have not been content to merely paint or sculpt facsimiles of nature. Some individuals felt a need to go beyond this and to actually animate their facsimiles. In the course of recorded history, you find mentions of robots back before BC, back in BC, 300 years before BC, back in the days of the Greeks. The Greek god Hephaestus was credited with creating mechanical handmaidens, maybe the first subservient female robot. He also came up with the alternative, a towering golden warrior named Talos, who was deployed to protect the island of Crete. From there, we find other evidence of would-be roboticists from the ancient world. We had, in 1206, we had a Muslim mathematician named Al-Jaziri. He built what may have been the world's first programmable robots. He designed a quartet of mechanical musicians that performed on a boat that would float nearby during royal drinking parties. I wish we had a videotape of that to show. And then along comes Leonardo da Vinci, who arguably built the world's first remote-controlled driverless automobile, and he left behind plans to build a mechanical knight that would actually sit up and move its jaw and wave its arms, presumably in a threatening manner. Following that, we had a Swiss watchmaker who really built some astonishing childlike automatons, and these are still around and you can see them on YouTube. He built three child robots. One of them had more than 6,000 moving parts, remember, in the body of a child. One of them could play a piano. One of them could draw a horse or a dog. And the third was capable of writing letters. These early robots were all powered by water and by weights and by hand-wound springs. But today, of course, our robots are powered by coal, oil, and electricity. The first electric robot that we know of was built in 1928 by a British inventor who powered his beast with a 12-volt motor. Western Electric was right behind in 1939 with a device called Electro. This was a towering aluminum-skinned giant that had the ability to move, and he could speak, and he could also smoke cigarettes. Those were the days. In 1996, here comes the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They were the first to build a robo-tuna, yep, a robot tuna fish. And Honda quickly comes on the scene with their invention, the first humanoid robot. It could carry on conversations. This is something that's one of the first things you want your robots to do. You want to be able to push the message. And in 2000, that's when we first saw the ever-charming, delightful Japanese robot Asimo. I'm sure you've all seen Asimo, about this tall, irresistibly cute. Asimo, it was kind of a childlike bot, and it can walk, it can dance. You may have seen it kicking a soccer ball to the President of the United States. It does that too. And then in 2004, we had a unique moment. Cornell University crossed a red line when it created the first robot that was capable of self-replication. That's quite a step. Today in Japan, there are entire factories that are filled with robots building other robots. And now, as natural life collapses under the sixth extinction, what do we have some of our brightest minds doing? We have robot researchers, and they're usually men between the ages of 20 and 40, powered by Pentagon dollars, our tax money. These guys are busy creating what you might call neo-Edens of robotic wildlife. They have created, and you can find these on YouTube to confirm it, they have created robot snakes, fish, dolphins, sharks, horses, hummingbirds, houseflies, and, God bless them, mosquitoes. And many of these little toys are designed to be weaponized by our military. Now, I'm thinking it's probably no accident that it's men who seem to have been obsessed with this artificial life thing. And I'm speculating that preoccupation may stem from something that maybe somebody else besides myself has called womb envy. The recognition that in the natural world, it's women who bring forth life. What a bummer if you're a man. The male obsession with creating life in the lab rather than the womb has been called the God complex. And yes, thanks to the grand march of masculine science, human embryos have now been successfully grown in artificial wombs. Now, a little bit about what lies ahead in the world of bioscience. There are breakthroughs coming in the next few years that will make cloning and xenotransplantation seem absolutely benign. At least when scientists in the old days planted a spider gene in a goat or inserted a pig cell into a human brain, they were at least dealing with natural ingredients. Give them some credit for that. Well, here is what they're working on now. A few examples of some what you might call biobot experiments. Let's begin with University of Reading professor Kevin Warwick. Did I almost say Warlock? I'm sorry. He has something called Project Cyborg, and he's had microchips implanted in his body so that computers can remotely monitor what he does, and this is really groovy, as he approaches doors, the doors will automatically open for him. I think that's the God complex at work again. And here we have the Pentagon working on brain implants that would empower soldiers to remotely control military robots. We've got researchers building living, not building, actually adapting living cockroaches by equipping them with microelectric backpacks that allow them to scamper around, but you can remotely steer them. Isn't that cool? You can remotely steer a cockroach. They're equipped with TV images that can be sent back to distant spy labs. The U.S. has also got some scientists who have built a robotic fish guided by the brain cell of an eel, and they've implanted biofuel cells in snails that turn them into, that allow them to turn their natural glucose into electricity. Now, I'm not sure what the thinking here is, but it could be that, you know, if your cell phone is about to die, you just plug in a snail. But this is what defense money goes for. Off in Britain, we've got scientists who've built robots that use a microbial fuel cell to power themselves when they're released into the wild. And how do they power themselves? By using these microbial fuel cells to feed on the bodies of living creatures. Robots that eat released in the wild. Now, Fox News recently reported that the Pentagon's energetically autonomous tactical robot, mark the acronym, it spells EATER, it powers itself by gobbling up whatever organic matter it can find, grass, wood, even dead bodies. Now, the Pentagon's Maryland-based contractor had to rush out with a press release saying that really our EATER machine is a strict vegetarian, not to worry. But not before the National Post wryly noted, headline, artificially intelligent, self-fueling killer machines? What could go wrong? A little history about war bots. It was Nazi Germany that fielded the first robot in World War II. It was called a Goliath. It was a crawling, remote-controlled bomb tethered to an electric leash. It was 4 foot square. It was kind of an IED on treads. And you could drive it right up and into an enemy bunker and then blow it up. In 2007, DARPA, our defense research agency, introduced a Goliath of their own in Iraq. The Special Weapons Observation Remote Direct Action System, aka SWORDS, was a ground-based radio-controlled killer droid with video eyeballs and an M249 light machine gun on its top. During its first deployment in Iraq, however, the SWORDS droids reportedly turned their weapons on U.S. forces, and the experiment was abruptly canceled. The Pentagon continues to deny this happened. The first Predator drones were launched during the Balkan War, and by the early 2000s, they were equipped with supersonic Hellfire missiles. While a Predator drone is about the size of a school bus, some of these are pretty large beasts. The Pentagon's current arsenal also includes a lot of small-scale war bots. Some are designed to look like and fly like birds, and we saw one in that video clip. The Sandia National Lab has built a remote-controlled flybot. It weighs 1 ounce, and it's slightly smaller than a dime. It's equipped with a TV scanner, a microphone, and a chemical microsensor. The microbot ostensibly exists to protect, we are told, U.S. military and economic interests. Go bot. Now, some of these spy bots resemble flying dominoes, and these can be released in swarms to infiltrate entire neighborhoods. They can follow targets down the street as they walk unobserved, and they can slip through doors and windows, and some of them can even quietly sneak up behind someone, behind a victim's head, before triggering a lethal explosion. These are weaponized flying dominoes. Now, because some of these drones rely on tires, treads, or tracks, ground-based drones are limited relative to the terrain. They need flat ground to walk on. But a machine with robotic feet can roam practically anywhere. And that's why in 2004, DARPA and Stanford University created a gecko-like sticky bot that was able to climb up vertical walls and perch on ceilings where it could spy on the activities below. Then came Big Dog, which we also saw clambering over the terrain in that video, a four-legged gas-powered metallic beast. It's built by Boston Dynamics. This one can whip up mountainsides and scramble across frozen lakes, carrying 400 pounds of weapons and or supplies, which is many times more than a human soldier could carry. This is a real, what the military calls, force multiplier. At UC Berkeley, not to be outdone by our rival Stanford, our search team came up with something called the Human Universal Load Carrier. And watch out for the acronym again, that spells HULK. It's a mechanical exoskeleton that can be strapped to a human body to endow the wearer with superhuman strength. So we've already gotten to the point we have robot-like humans. Now, the next step, obviously, is human-like robots. And these creatures are being designed to think the same way that human beings do, not just to move, not just to respond like a human would do in a physical environment, but they're capable of thinking, they're capable of outthinking us. They can detect emotions and even infer hidden motives. In other words, these robots can tell when you're lying to them. And this can be useful. In South Korea today, Samsung robots have replaced human guards along the border with North Korea. When these robots detect the approach of a human, they demand a password. And if they don't get the correct answer, they're programmed to fire automatically. So never lie to a robot on the South North Korea border. DARPA's ultimate professed goal is to take man out of unmanned warfare, their phrase. This means building war bots that have the capacity to make their own decisions about who to kill. And this takes us beyond mere artificial life and into the boundary of artificial intelligence. And this, we have been warned, promises to bring us to an alpha barrier. When you cross that barrier, that means you've crossed a point at which a single new discovery can radically transform all future technological innovations. A U.S. Joint Forces Command study predicts deployment of fully autonomous battlefield robots by the year 2025. And sure, like humans, these super strong and super smart warbots will occasionally make mistakes and kill innocent civilians. But unlike humans, they won't experience guilt or suffer from PTSD. On November 21, 2012, the Pentagon issued a 15-page directive calling for an autonomous weapons system that, once activated, can select and engage targets without human supervision. But the Pentagon had already taken steps in 2005 to build a $130 billion robot army, the Future Combat Systems Program. The largest military contract on record at that time was designed to replace human robots with mechanical terminators at one-tenth the cost. Eliminating humans from the combat workforce would save billions in combat pay and veterans benefits. The Navy, meanwhile, has already developed prototype missiles and ships that can seek out and engage the enemy without human oversight. But there is resistance. In 2009, The International Committee for Robot Arms Control announced a coalition campaign to stop killer robots, and in May 2013, a UN report called for a temporary ban to prevent robot arms races that, as they noted, quote, threaten, their note was, their observation was, tireless war machines ready for deployment at the push of a button pose the danger of permanent armed conflict. Meanwhile, Gordon Johnson of the U.S. Joint Forces Research Center has no qualms about unleashing killer robots on the world. He recently told the New York Times, "The lawyers tell me there are no prohibitions against robots making life or death decisions." Problem solved. Finally, something else to worry about, the singularity. This is the point at which human beings merge with technology. Our minds, as some would have it, meld with our machines. Our machines transcend our natural bodies and we become immortal, or some might say we will become irrelevant. The nonprofit Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence believes that the technological creation of computer-assisted superhuman intelligence will produce an immediate worldwide and material improvement to the human condition, but others are not so sure. In his book, The Singularity is Near, Ray Kurzweil predicts that the merging of biological and artificial intelligence will lead to computers that are conscious, feeling beings deserving of the same rights, privileges, and consideration people give to each other. There are profound dangers, however, he mentioned, but I don't think you can stop it. Asked how bad a post-human world might be, Victor Vingi, the originator of the singularity concept, concluded, quote, "How bad could things be? Well, pretty bad. The physical extinction of the human race is one possibility. When the singularity occurs, Vingi says, it could happen in the blink of an eye, an exponential runaway beyond any hope of control. It will probably occur faster than any technical revolution seen so far. Even if all the governments of the world were to understand the threat and be in deadly fear of it, progress toward the goal would continue." Tesla founder Elon Musk recently observed, "I don't think anyone realizes how fast artificial intelligence is advancing. The collective fear is that superintelligent machines could become so smart that they might conclude, quite logically, that human beings are a threat to planetary survival and respond responsibly by destroying all human life." How is that for an irony? The artistic impulse to build robots to escape the biological noose of human mortality could bring us to the point where we've created a technological guillotine that might lead to human extinction. In his book, Macroshift, Irvin Laszlo argues that the industrial civilization is destined to disappear without a profound and rapid macro shift from economic globalization to a new and sustained civilization. Instead of conquest, colonization, and consumption, future survival will require connection, communication, and consciousness. Meanwhile, we face a hard truth. Our technology has created problems that can seemingly only be solved by more technology. Case in point, last point, the Fukushima meltdowns. It's impossible for any living thing to enter the broken reactors and attempt to contain the damage, so the order has gone out, send in the robots. With our divided brains physiologically locked in an endless left-right contest between logic and emotion, reason and intuition, between technophilia and naturophilia, we would do well to recall the words of Albert Einstein, who said, "The intuitive mind is the sacred gift, and the rational mind is the faithful servant." And let us heed the counsel of psychiatrist Ian McGilchrist, who said, "We have created a society that honors the servant but has forgotten the gift." Thank you.